Well, I wanted to do a number of things. First of all, I wanted to do a very careful job of looking at the coverage of SDS by two major organs of the media, story by story, and looking at the relation between what was happening and what was reported. And then I wanted to try to trace out what was the impact of that whole publicity process on the way in which the movement developed.
Can you give us a little overview of some of the things that you found?
Well, just looking at the coverage for a minute, the first thing to say about it is that for a long time there wasn't any coverage of the movement. So one thing I learned in general, and I think this is true of movements of the 70s and will be true of movements of the 80s, that they have to cross a certain threshold in order to be noticed at all. And the threshold can be pretty high. A lot of activity may have to take place before a movement gets on the political map as a movement at all. And then I found a mixture of coverage which was sometimes respectful. That is, it sometimes took people in the movement at face value and gave a version of what they thought. But more often, it trivialized the movement. It presented it as something freakish, something bizarre, something perhaps that respectable people wouldn't want to touch with a 10-foot pole. And also a great deal of the coverage showed the movement to be menacing, dangerous, hostile, anti-American, and so on. That was the main finding that I made about coverage of the New Left, and I think this is true of opposition movements in general as they are framed by the media.
A lot of pretty inflammatory things and anti-American things were in fact said during the student protests of the period, but do you think that that was changed in some way in the way it was portrayed on the press? Do you think it would seem more militant than it was meant to be?
Well, my view is that in the late 60s, a kind of symbiosis developed between the more militant, more extravagant sounding and looking people in the movement and the media, so that the media were amplifying something that was really there, but they were giving the impression that it was the major thing that was there. And that did have the effect of actually amplifying the reality of it. The media image then reflected back into the reality.
One of the points that you bring up in your book is that the media needed leaders, spokespeople from the different groups, and many of the groups were run pretty democratically. Decisions were reached through long meetings where everybody had a voice.
Very long meetings.
Very long meetings, right. But suddenly there was a spokesperson, a leader, who got a lot of publicity and sometimes even became transformed into a celebrity. Do you think that process is inevitable when groups are having interactions with the media, since you can't interview a whole group and you can't do an interview by consensus?
No, I think there's an automatic tendency toward it on the part of the media because of the assumption, which is reasonable enough, it's shared by journalists and viewers, that or listeners as the case may be, that it's individuals who make things happen. So journalists are going to go out and look for somebody who sounds articulate and can give you a good quotation. But I don't think it follows necessarily that they should single out one. I mean, why not two? Why not four? Nor does it follow that they should pick out the same one and stay with that person as the fixed leader. But they have, I think journalism has in its collective head an idea of celebrity, according to which, like money, it takes some to get some. And that means that they tend to try to reduce a story to formula, and if you can peg it to a single individual, I think it's easy to process the information. So I don't have a devil theory about how this concentration on celebrities comes about. I think it's a reasonable and natural response of journalists to the demands of their work situation. They're on deadlines. They've got this complicated reality going on that they may not have any direct experience with. They have to interpret it quickly. They're under a lot of pressure. So they come to formula. So they come to celebrity. But I think it's resistible, too.
Well, let's look at some of the people who became celebrities of a sort during the 60s and early 70s, and I'm thinking of Mark Rudd of SDS, of Jerry Rubin and Abbie Hoffman. Mm-hmm. To what extent do you think their notoriety was something that came from the way media portrayed them?
Oh, absolutely. No question about it in those three cases. Mark Rudd was the newly elected head of the SDS chapter at Columbia University, but he was only one of many leaders, all of whom were personable and articulate in different ways. And yet one had the impression from watching the news or reading the Times or any other newspaper in America or in the world that he was the single leader. And it was as if there had been a kind of central casting, you know, get us a radical. He's got to talk in slogans. He's got to sound inflammatory. He's got to sound very angry and so on. And most of all, he has to be someone who seems to be more of an actor than a thinker. Because the general convention about people in movements is that they perform actions, but they don't have ideas. So he was put on the political map as a national character by the media, and then he was able to parlay his celebrity into increased power within SDS itself. In fact, he became a national leader in that final phase of SDS, which turned into the Weather, first the Weathermen and then the Weather Underground, very largely, as he admitted at the time, on the basis of his celebrity to which he had been assigned by media.
Was there any resistance to that within the organization?
Yes, there was.
But it was a very difficult
thing to resist, because once you would have been assigned the role of central casting radical leader, it was very hard to get off that. And some people tried. I give the example in my book of Dan Siegel, who was a student leader at Berkeley at the time, gave the speech at People's Park, which sent people down to the park, and the result was all the shooting and days of nightmare. Well, there was a period when he tried really to tell reporters to go away, and they wouldn't go away. And it's very difficult, I think, when you have been assigned that role to break off it. Once you become a household word, it seems that you don't lose it. And it's a very difficult problem for leaders. I have a lot of sympathy for people in a leadership situation under such conditions, because at certain moments, there doesn't seem to be anything they can do to get off the hook.
You talked to a lot of journalists mm-hmm. who were working at that time. Did they feel any tension between what they wanted to cover and what was expected of them because of the format they were working in, or what editors were telling them to do? And I don't want to generalize too much. Maybe you could tell us specifically about some of the people who you interviewed.
Sometimes they felt that tension acutely, especially as they became persuaded that the war didn't make sense. At the beginning, let us not forget, most of the reporters were not critical of the war, even in Vietnam. They might have been critical of particular policies, or they might have said that it wasn't working, but they weren't critical of the thrust of it, the purpose of it. But as time went on, certainly by 68, 69, I think a majority of reporters were critical of the war, and moreover, they had been the objects of police attacks by now. But they often felt this sort of tension. One way it would play itself out, for example, is that they were leery of doing anything that seemed to express their own opinions. And they would bend over backwards. So, for example, terms that were used by the anti-war movement were always placed within quotation marks. So the reporter could always tell a hostile editor, "I'm not saying this. I'm simply quoting them saying this." Okay, that was a way in which a reporter could sort of keep clean hands. Another thing that reporters would do would be to make sure that the story was overbalanced. In other words, if they had a statement from somebody in the anti-war movement, they would try to make sure to get a statement from somebody in the military or somebody in the police, something that still goes on. Another thing that would happen is that they would be at pains to distinguish between respectable anti-war types and illegitimate anti-war types. And I go into that in the book in some detail. By the end of 69, this was a very noticeable sort of distinction within the media. And interestingly enough, I think one of the motivations behind it was this desire of anti-war reporters and editors to find a way of expressing their anti-war sentiment, or their, not so much sentiment, but their own distaste for what was going on in Washington without being marked as dangerously far out.
Now, at the same time, there was a number of underground presses developing and alternative presses who felt that there was no sense in having the pretense of objectivity when everybody knows that people have opinions, and that it was okay to have opinions, and therefore newspapers had a definite point of view, didn't feel obliged to get balancing point of views each time somebody who was anti-war or draft resistor was quoted. Did you evaluate their coverage of the student movement?
I didn't go into that in the book. That would have been another book. But I do feel that although the underground press, which I was involved in writing for and at one point editing for myself, although it had its own point of view, which was by no means the dominant establishment point of view, still in all, many of its ways of evaluating news were not so different from the mainstream. That is, it was also sensationalist. It also was celebrity-centered. It also over-reported the sort of extravagant stuff that was going on in the fringe of the crowd, the violence, the Viet Cong flags, the flag burning, and that sort of thing. And in some odd way, I think it was the shadow of the establishment media in many cases, and that helps explain why it burned itself out, I think. In other words, it had really some of the same notions of journalism, but with the black hats and white hats inverted, you know? They said cowboys were better than Indians. We say Indians are better than cowboys, but it's understanding the world in the same terms. I realize what I'm saying sounds strange, but I think it was so, although it was hard to see it that way at the time. It was a lot of, in other words, cheerleading and not so much analysis.
Oh, let's look a little bit about what both presses interpreted as being newsworthy.
Mm-hmm.
Were there a certain type of event or certain type of thing happening within an event, a rally, that qualified as news or?
Well, the sort of things that I'm talking about, the Viet Cong flag, the flag burning, the upside down flag, somebody throwing a pie in somebody's face, or somebody at one point the Yippies, I think it was, were delivering the heads of pigs to various people they didn't like, you know, to make the point that this person is a quote pig, that kind of thing. Anything that sort of seemed like a sideshow, mm-hmm. like a freak show. It was very hard for an organization on the left to strip itself of that impression, even when it went to the effort. And one piece I analyze in the book was the case of the coverage of a respectable, very moderate anti-war demonstration in the fall of 65, organized by SANE, the Committee for Insane Nuclear Policy, in which the organizers were so much at pains to establish that they were legitimate that they publicly sent a telegram to Ho Chi Minh urging him not to assume that this demonstration was a support of North Vietnam. It was not. And yet, the day before the demonstration, the story in the New York Times on page 4, big story, big long headline, Viet Cong flag sold in Washington on eve of demonstration. And the story reports that an organization called the United States Committee to Support the National Liberation Front of South Vietnam is selling Viet Cong flags. And then there's a picture of this flag, NLF flag, with the caption, "This is an NLF flag. It was captured last summer by soldiers outside Da Nang," and you see a Saigon soldier. So the connection here is very clear. You know, this is the enemy, and there are these enemy endorsers in Washington. Well, nowhere in the article is the size of this group reported. But there doesn't seem to be any doubt at all, in my mind, and from people I've talked to, that this group never had more than 5 people, maybe didn't even have 3 people in it. And yet the same newspaper that's so concerned with the size of demonstrations never reported that this was a minuscule thing. It meant nothing in terms of the general demonstration. But even, my point is that even SANE, which had gone to all these lengths, meeting with people in the White House, sending a telegram to Ho Chi Minh and so on, gone all these lengths to establish how clean they were, and still they couldn't escape being tarred with this brush. So it's that kind of thing that one sees reported disproportionately in the 60s. Anything that was violent on the fringe of a crowd, the idea of left-wing and right-wing activities being sort of equivalent, extremists of both sides, that sort of framing, all that was the rule rather than the exception.
Can you give us some examples of articles that you went back and read in your research for your book that misrepresented events You've given us a couple.
Well, around the time of the same thing, I'll tell you what CBS did on that same demonstration. It's rather interesting. The day before the demonstration, Bruce Morton of CBS reporting that the White House fence had been reinforced for the occasion, said at one point, "All in all, there have been so many demonstrations against the war in Vietnam." And then he turned to the march coordinator. What makes you think that yours is going to be any more effective? So the framing here, in other words, was that all this activity is for naught. It's accomplishing nothing. Now, note, it's November 1965, and already he's talking about all these demonstrations that have taken place. So I call that a kind of framing which establishes the point that none of this is worth much. The Times treatment of the first anti-war demonstration in Washington was interesting, the New York Times treatment. It begins with the line, more than 15,000 students and a handful of adults picketed the White House in warm spring sunshine today, calling for an end to the fighting in Vietnam. Rather extraordinary sort of statement of the implication here, clearly that students are not adults, they don't know what they're talking about. Later on in the article, somebody is quoted as saying it's a holiday from exams, and that's a subhead, holiday from exams. One gets the general impression that most of these kids don't know what they're talking about, and it's a lark, really. It's warm spring sunshine. There's nothing very menacing here. I contrasted that in the book to their coverage of the Montgomery to Selma march a month earlier, in which it was reported that Martin Luther King had led a demonstration of Negroes and whites, to use the terms of those years, to within the shadow of the state capitol. So one has, metaphorically, it's interesting, the Alabama capitol casts a shadow, but the White House is bathed in warm spring sunshine. And by the way, the anti-war demonstration also had what was, for that time, a rather large representation of blacks. Probably 10% of that demonstration were blacks, but that's nowhere mentioned in the article. Nor is the political position of SDS, which organized the march, mentioned anywhere in the article. Nor are the contents of the picket sign slogans mentioned anywhere in the article. Nor is the content of the speeches at the rally mentioned anywhere in the article. And the news photos, which were sent out by United Press International, which show the size of the demonstration, are not reprinted. The one that is printed is the one that shows what looks like maybe 100 anti-war demonstrators and then another 100 pro-war demonstrators. So one gets the impression from the picture that they're about equal in size, whereas in fact, by their own account, there were 15,000, other people said 25,000, anti-war demonstrators, and 100 of the neo-Nazis and Delaware County Citizens for Victory Over Communism, who were the pro-war demonstrators. One of the other photos they didn't use, by the way, which I got out of UPI's files, shows the rally at the Washington Monument. And when you look at the faces and the dress of the people at this anti-war rally, you might think that you were at the high school prom or the West Point graduation or something. Everybody has short hair, and a lot of people wearing jackets and ties. People look as straight as all get out. And yet the article makes a point of beards and sandals mixed in with clerical collars. So those were quite the usual sorts of items that one read in reports in those years.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Todd Gitlin, and we're talking about the subject of his new book called The Whole World is Watching, Mass Media in the Making and Unmaking of the New Left. And what he's done is gone back to a lot of the journalism of the 1960s and examined how it covered radical politics of the time, or rallies and demonstrations, and compare it to what really happened. He himself was head of SDS from 63 to 64, so had a lot of personal involvement in the student movement of that period. Now, you are on the faculty of the University of California at Berkeley now, and you're head of the mass media program there.
Right.
So you're potentially on the other side of the fence now. I mean, you're not a member of the media within that department, but you're a kind of intermediator between people who will eventually be media people.
Right.
And you're supposed to be teaching what it is and how to do it better. What's some of the things that you tell your students. I don't know exactly what the nature of your work is there, but I'm sure that you try to deal with a lot of the questions that you raise in your book and your approach to working with the students.
Sure I do. And I try to get across, one thing I try to get across is that these are systemic problems. It's not that anybody necessarily has any ill will. These are real problems. If I were working at the New York Times, I mean, I would be facing a lot of these problems, and I would be up against deadlines, and I would be looking for formulas, and I would be looking for prominent newsmakers so I don't have to keep a lot of names rattling around in my head, and so on. And I think, in other words, that the industry has a kind of momentum of its own. Its rules make sense, just as academic rules make sense, many of them, not all of them, but many of them in its own terms. And in other words, one has to understand that these are problems of structure, not of malevolence or wickedness. Another thing I try to get across is that it's not easy to imagine changing the mass media system without changing a lot of other aspects of the society, because the whole society is hooked on the values that are enshrined in journalism, right? The value of individualism, the value of individual success, the value of celebrity, the value of glamour, the whole idea of people vicariously identifying with their heroes on television, whether it's fictional heroes on soap operas or primetime, or news heroes, or anchor heroes, Walter Cronkite heroes, or presidential heroes, but people really have an appetite for the spectacular view of the world, of, you know, which white hats are up against black hats and fighting it out at the pass.